We welcome back to the show from Boston Sports Journal, great friend of the program who's got a wonderful new book out called The Franchise, A Curated History of the Sox. Sean McAdam joins us. Sean, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, guys. Nice to be on with you, as always.
What a wonderful read this is. I could not put this down when I got it last week. I loved it, and I love the way the book is organized, too.
Well, thank you, Rich. I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was your proverbial labor of love to put together, although there were perhaps a swear word or two uttered along the way and meeting deadlines. But in general, it was a positive experience. And, you know, it was the kind of thing where you're tasked with telling the story of a franchise that, you know, dates back 120 or so years, a charter American League franchise, and kind of like looking up at the top of the mountain and wondering where to start. So I made some decisions pretty early on, and I should at this point thank Triumph Books of Chicago, the publishers who approached me on this project, and basically, you know, left it in my hands as to what to focus on. And I made the decision pretty early on that it was going to be mostly modern in its focus, which is to say from 1960 or so on. I know there are probably younger listeners who don't regard 62 years ago as terribly modern, but those of us of a certain age might disagree. And, you know, I realized early on that I couldn't write the comprehensive history of the Red Sox without devoting years and years and thousands of pages. So it is, as the title promises, curated. And there are some dives into the early part of the franchise, the purchase of the franchise by Tom Yawkey and his ownership, which goes, if you count his estate, didn't end until 20 years ago. The history of the ballpark, Fenway, its evolution, its updated nature over the last 20 or so years. And then, you know, figures like Ted Williams, without whom you can't possibly tell the story of the Red Sox. But a lot of it, as you can see by looking at the table of contents and the chapter outlines, is kind of post-1960, or maybe Yaz is the dividing point from the beginning of Carl Yastrzemski's Red Sox career in 1961. Most of the book focuses on that era.
Well, and when you talk about the park, that's such an important part of the story, because I would say, maybe the Red Sox and the Cubs, and perhaps nobody else, has a history that is as intricately connected to the park that they play in.
Yeah, that's true. And as I write, for a number of years, maybe even decades, it's possible that Fenway served as a detriment to the Red Sox success, because we all know that for too long, the team seemed to overvalue things like right-handed power because of the inviting left field wall and the monster, and didn't pay nearly as much attention to other aspects of the game like pitching and defense. And it's probably no surprise that when you look at the 2004 team that finally ended the championship drought of 86 years, that, you know, that team had a rotation that included two Hall of Fame caliber pitchers in Pedro Martinez and Curt Schilling, and a third in Derek Lowe, who was enormously important to that staff. And, you know, the changes they made in mid-season with the Nomar trade to improve the defense at short and first, it was as if a light finally went on and said, oh, you don't have to win every game 10-9. And what do you know, a few months later, they were finally champions.
And as much as we like to think of Fenway as America's most beloved ballpark, you point out there have been at least a couple occasions along the way where the Sox were certainly open to a brand new stadium and even a new location.
Yeah, in the mid-60s, that's why that 1967 team is so important, not for not just for baby boomers like the two of us, Rich, as probably our our gateway drug to Red Sox Nation, but also because it probably quite literally saved the franchise from having to move out of the city. You know, in the early to mid-60s, the team was not competitive. The average attendance was about 10,000 per game. You could walk up minutes before first pitch and get yourself a great box seat near the playing field. And Tom Yawkey began to wonder whether it was good business to remain in Boston in a downtown area where the real estate was costly, and began to think about and explore some moves out to the suburbs. This was a time when, you know, there was kind of a flight from urban areas to the suburbs in the 60s. And he at least began to explore his options there. And, of course, the success of the 67 team kind of put that to bed for a long time. The Red Sox became relevant again. A generation of fans got on the bandwagon and never left. And Fenway, you know, with some investments and a facelift or three along the way, you know, remains somewhat viable here some 55 years later. But that was not the case at all in the 60s. Fenway's future was very much in question back then.
We're talking with Sean McAdam about his new book on the Red Sox called The Franchise, and I had not looked at the chapters ahead of time. I just jumped right in, and when I got to chapter 4, a big smile came to my face because I was so delighted when you talked about the media to see that you wrote about my favorite Red Sox broadcaster of all time, the great Ned Martin.
Yeah, he fits that bill for me too, Rich, and you know, that's you know, the old saying is to the victor go the spoils. Well, to the author go the topic. And I got to choose, you know, some of my own personal heroes, among them Ned Martin as one of my absolute favorite broadcasters of all time, and certainly Peter Gammons, who is part of that chapter as well, Jerry Remy, who I was lucky enough to call a friend and get to know very well over the last 25 years or so. But yeah, Ned, I think, is terribly underrated and sadly underappreciated. I think he long ago should have won, you know, the award that goes annually, the Ford Frick Award that goes annually to one broadcaster, and he's recognized in Cooperstown. It's too bad that Ned is not there. I find that inconceivable. He was so erudite and so learned and could have such a good time introducing, you know, elements of play and tying them to history or literature. You know, he was not he did not spend a lot of time on launch angle or UZR in his time, but he made watching Red Sox games endlessly entertaining, whether they were winning or losing, and he did so in such a delightful manner. To me, he's missed all the time.
I still have a vivid memory because only Ned Martin would have done this. And it was in the midst of a difficult season and yet another game, and I don't remember the year, but another game slipped away, and Ned, as only he could do, just dropped in, "When sorrows come, they come not single spies, but in battalions."
Yeah, and sometimes when he wanted to be a little more economical, he would just drop a mercy on you. That could be good or bad. That could be a great Red Sox rally that came to fruition, or it could be a 17-3 beating. But he had a remarkable way about him to use the language and really entertain you.
I love your chapters on the icons: Ted Williams, Carl Yastrzemski, David Ortiz. Can you, without giving away too much, can you share a little bit of the wonderful story about when you were in college at Providence and you managed to get Ted Williams on your radio show?
Yeah, it actually wasn't in college, Rich. It was shortly after.
Oh, okay.
I was working with I think it was probably 1982 or 3. I was out of college, but working in Providence Radio. I was a producer for Chuck Wilson, who many may remember having worked at ESPN Radio, in addition to the Providence market for a long time. Chuck was a great interviewer, and I learned so much about the sports media business from him. And I served as his producer. And we happened to make acquaintances with the gentleman who ran Ted Williams' baseball camp in Lakeville, Massachusetts, which is kind of over in the over near the New Bedford area in southeastern Mass. The gentleman who ran the camp listened to the show, and we had mentioned to him almost on a lark that, gee, if Ted's ever by, maybe you could arrange for us to speak to him via the phone and be a guest on the show. And he said, well, sure, I'll bring it up. And we thought, well, yes, that'll happen. And then with about an hour's notice once, he called us and said, hey, I talked to Ted, and he'd be happy to come on with you. And after our jaws collectively hit the floor and we picked them up, Chuck did, an hour of prep and a list of questions that you would want to ask Ted Williams. I was that night his co-host with him. And I'll leave out the end of the story, because I think it's probably better when you read it.
But, yes.
It was a thrilling hour of radio, and the length has something to do with how things end up. But we just couldn't believe our good fortune that the famously reclusive and anti-media superstar Ted Williams was giving us this time and allowing people to call in to ask questions of him. And, I have a tape of that somewhere, and that is a prized possession. And I'll leave the denouement of that story to the readers, because I think it has a better impact when you're reading it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful kicker to the story there. I also appreciate the fact that, again, another name that perhaps younger fans don't know, but so important to the history of this team, and that's when you wrote about former GM Dick O'Connell.
Yeah, every interview I've done about the book, Rich, and I've only done one in-store signing appearance, but that name comes up with every interviewer, and if it doesn't, I make sure it does. Because, I was young and followed the team from 67 on, and I was aware that there was a gentleman named Dick O'Connell who was in charge of making trades. This was before free agency ever existed in Marvin Miller's eye. But I knew that he was the guy that put the team together. And over the years, I've read a great deal about him and done some research. But I think he, too, is sadly underrated in Red Sox history. I've noted that with, the better bounce of a ball or a break here or there, Dick O'Connell could have been the architect of 4 American League pennant winners in the span of 11 years. He was the architect, of the 67 team, of the 75 team, and then he also put together, of course, the 72 team that finished a half game out due to the inequities of the schedule after the early season strike, and then, of course, famously, the 78 team that lost in the playoff game to the Yankees, after which O'Connell was fired. But not only did he put together a stretch of 4 contenders, and 2 pennant winners who went on to lose Game 7 of the World Series twice. But he also changed the narrative of the team's history. As we know, sadly, the Red Sox are saddled with the ignominious distinction of being the last team to integrate in 1959 when they added Pumpsy Green to the roster. And for the longest time, the Red Sox were also the whitest and most exclusionary team, even after Pumpsy Green. And Dick O'Connell stepped into a bit of a power vacuum. There were people in the organization who sort of receded into the background, and O'Connell had more power over the composition of the team than he ever had before, and decided that he was not going to be tied to the racist or exclusionary policies of the past, and put together a 67 team that had an African-American at third base, first base, center field for the month of September and into the World Series behind the plate. There was a Latino starting pitcher. There was an African-American closer. And that began a turnaround of the narrative of the Red Sox, that this was not the old boy network with a whites-only policy. He decided he was going to put the best 25 guys on the roster and on the field, regardless of skin color or language or ethnicity, and damn the consequences. And along the way, oversaw a scouting and development program that produced Tony Conigliaro, Rico Petrocelli, Reggie Smith, Jim Lomborg, Carlton Fisk, Fred Lynn, Jim Rice, and others. And Bill Lee is another who came up under his watch. So he did three things. He developed a great farm system and scouting organization to find young talent. He put winning teams on the field, and he erased an ugly chapter of the team's history.
By the way, 63 years ago tomorrow, Pumpsy Green played his first game with the Red Sox.
Wow, didn't realize that we were coming up on that anniversary.
The book is wonderful. It is The Franchise, A Curated History of the Sox. Sean, we have to ask about this year's edition of the Sox before we let you go. They get back at it, a series with the Blue Jays starting on Friday. And the big question in the minds of the fans is, are they buyers or sellers at the deadline?
Yeah, that's a good question, Rich. And, you know, I wrote a couple of days ago that they're kind of right on the precipice. You know, they're only two games out of the final wild card. It wasn't long ago that they were leading the wild card race. And, you know, with a good bit of momentum, if they can win some games to start coming out of the break, they could be back. But they're also only 2.5 games out of last place in the American League East, and there's no guarantees here. So I thought they could go any number of three ways, buy, sell, or maybe a little combination of both. In talking to some people around the game, in and out of the organization the last couple of days, my strong sense is for now, and you know, if they were to go 1-9 on this upcoming homestand, that could obviously change. But the information I'm getting from people both in and out of the organization is that this team is going to be looking to improve the team and add talent at that August 2nd deadline, with some obvious needs at the bullpen, and either, probably not both, but either an upgrade at first base or right field. It's clear they need an offensive upgrade at least one of those two. It may be too much to ask to do both and still improve the bullpen, but my sense is that, you know, they're ready to jump in with 2 feet, that they see this team as a viable contender who just went through a bad couple of weeks, brought on at least in part by a tsunami of injuries to the starting rotation. Now most of those guys are coming back, though obviously they've lost Chris Sale for a second time. So they're kind of bullish at Fenway Park from what I can understand, and I would expect they're going to be aggressive.
Well, Sean, great to talk with you as always. Now, this can't be possible. I think I read the other day, is this true that you are the longest tenured writer on the Red Sox beat? How can that be when you're so young?
It's a mystery to me, Rich, and it's a question I ask every day as I limp into the press box and rest my sore back in a chair somewhere. But somewhere along the way, I have gained that ignominious distinction. Yes, that's true. This is season number 34 and counting.
Well, all of that wonderful knowledge, institutional knowledge, great research, and tremendous writing skills, all available to you right now in this wonderful history of the Red Sox, The Franchise, from Sean McAdam, with a foreword by a guy named David Ortiz. It is a wonderful read. Sean, congratulations on a terrific book, and thanks, as always, for visiting with us this afternoon.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, Rich. I appreciate your kind words about it. I would tell people that it's available first and foremost at your local independent bookstore, but also at the bigger brick and mortars like Barnes and Noble, and also on Amazon online and wherever you get your books. So thanks for the opportunity to talk about it. I appreciate it. I know you've got a great audience and a lot of Red Sox fans, and I hope they pick it up and enjoy it as you did.
Well, I hope they do too. And we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks, Sean.
Thanks, Rich.
Sean McAdam with us on Downtown.